Conservation, and I work on the Environmental Review Branch. I thank you all for attending, and as usual, Maine is kind of in a different situation than a lot of the other states. Not only is the technology a little bit different that's being proposed offshore Maine currently, but also a lot of you, I think probably almost everyone in here probably participated in some of the panel discussion that the Island Institute helped put together last year, the results of which are posted on the Island Institute's website. And so you guys are a lot of times in a little bit of a different place, and I hope to build upon what our previous efforts have been, and really try to drill down into some of these issues a little deeper than maybe we have in some of the previous years. So that is always a challenge, but I'm putting that challenge for you all today. thanks. Did you even introduce yourself, by the way?
Yeah, with the
EMT.
Official presentation.
Button pusher. She's got a big figure.
So the organization of what we're going to be doing, I'll talk about the different stages of development. Some of them may or may not be applicable for how things are progressing in Maine with the current proposal before us. The purpose of the workshops, the wind energy area status, what our current best management practices are, the opportunities for input, and briefly give you an update on our environmental studies program. And this, this effort, once again, is not meant to interfere with perhaps anything that Statoil or any other developers in this area are already doing. Next slide. Generally speaking, the way that we operate is we have the ability to, the way the program is set up is, anybody can solicit BOEM with an application saying, I'd like to put a wind facility here or here or here. What BOEM did, for the most part, is say, well, this is going to get a little bit out of hand. Let's work with the states and identify wind energy areas. And that's pretty much what's happened, everywhere south of Maine. There is one other unsolicited application, which is what Maine has with Statoil. There was no wind energy area identified. And we received an application from an entity that would, identifying an area, and they wanted to process that application. So after what we had in Maine and what's going on in New York as well right now, has an open comment period on what we determined, what's called a determination of no competitive interest, meaning there's no other company that really wants to build a wind facility in that same area. And then after that point, then we can start getting into the actual leasing side of things. At which point we'll do another environmental assessment, and then eventually leading to the lease issuance.
So who in the state decides where that is? The Environmental Protection Agency or what?
As far as like, what do you mean?
You said that you work with the states to determine where the wind energy places are.
Right.
And so when you say the state, I just am interested what part of the state.
Right. Well, this is the task force consultation. So the state identifies who the representatives are on the what we call the intergovernmental task force. So there's members of BOEM, other federal agencies, as well as representatives of different state agencies. They all sit together on the intergovernmental task force, and it's through that process.
Okay.
So what we're talking about now is the best management practices eventually will come into play when we actually start receiving plans. Site assessment plans are for usually wind energy assessments, how much wind output is actually out there, and then eventually into the construction and operations plan when we receive actually how they want to construct the facility and how they're going about doing that. So,
can you just? I'm sorry to interrupt.
Sure.
But her question kind of almost confused things a little bit more. That you talk about that this was an unsolicited lease request, right? So,
yes,
nobody picked out an area.
No, that's true. In the situation with Maine, it was an unsolicited application from a single developer.
So no one has gone through a process of picking out any proper areas or areas that are best suited for wind energy or anything like that in Maine.
That's correct. At least not on the federal side. I don't know if the state may have done some preliminary things, but I don't think there's been anything formal introduced.
You mean that Statoil's proposed leasing area is not formal, or?
No, that's a formal request, but there wasn't necessarily a process through the task force that an independent group kind of identified, you know, where the applications should go.
Oh, okay.
Through their own consultation, their own iterative process, they identified an area that they thought had low conflict. Daryl, would you have those questions?
There's two ways to start that identification process. One is through if there is in effect an unsolicited lease, we go to the state and we say, we'd like to put a task force together to look at this. Do you want to broaden the scope in terms of looking at areas outside of that, or do you just want to focus on this particular proposal? And through the consultation process with the state, the decision was made just to focus on the Statoil proposal at this time. And it doesn't mean that at some later time down the road, that task force might could revisit the issue at some point. Mm-hmm. Is that?
Yep.
So the purpose of the workshops is to provide comments on the actual construction operational phases. As you are probably well aware, a lot of our public notice and comment thus far has been more on like the determination of competitive interest or any requests for general information regarding the area that was identified by Statoil. But you know, now we're trying to focus in on, okay, we're going to eventually start receiving some plans once leases are issued. And we'd like to get your feedback on you know, how we implement these best management practices when reviewing these plans that are submitted to us. Eventually, we'll have an updated list of best management practices and then be able to work on applying those to our review of the plan. So there will be a final report after the conclusion of these meetings that will be available on our website and in a draft form, and we'll notify you when that's out there and solicit comments to make sure we captured everything that you said. You also have the opportunity to, when the meeting summary is posted, to submit comments to me too. But there will eventually be a report from these series of meetings. Next slide. So how do we get to this workshop phase? It was identified as a need to address basically the construction operation phases, where previously a lot of, as I mentioned, we were directed primarily at the site assessment and site characterization activities associated with the lease and hadn't really gotten into construction and operations very much. So BOEM, along with Ecology and Environment, we consulted with federal partners, fishery councils, and wind energy representatives to try to figure out how to best structure these meetings. And then based upon council lists and other stakeholder mailing lists, we were able to send invitations out. And that was primarily as a need for us to be able to try to properly staff the event to have a successful workshop and be able to capture all the information available. So this is basically the same map that's on the stand-up chart over there, just with all the where all the current wind energy areas and applications are. The one difference you'll see on this one, the only other unsolicited application. So we have Maine. This is another unsolicited application off of New York that we have, and that is actually in the open comment period right now. And then we have, off of North Carolina, we have three other sites identified. Once again, I did want to point out that, you know, this is federal fishing vessel trip reports, all gear types. for that period, and we do realize that obviously that doesn't capture a lot of the fisheries such as lobster and that type of thing, and kind of point that out, we fully understand that. We're just showing you some of the data we've collected thus far from the folks that do submit the logbook data. Next slide. So we, we have begun embarking on one of the issues that has been raised previously is also not trying to capture so much current fishing data, but also, where historically fisheries have been located. And so to that end, on our own, without repeating a lot of the work that's actually the Northeast region through NROC and the Island Institute is compiling a very extensive participatory mapping effort. And we're trying not to repeat that, and we're looking forward to those results. And we've seen some preliminary results already on that effort, and we definitely are supportive of that of that effort. But so what this is some of the back in the 70s, Walford and Freeman did an entire anglers atlas of the Atlantic coast, and we just recently completed the digitization of that project. That kind of showed, back in the 60s and in early 70s, where some of the fishing effort was occurring with the interviews that they did. Next slide, please. So then we took that information and digitized that as well. So it was just trying to add to the body of knowledge that was already had been done previously, and making that available. So eventually this will all be available up on our multi-purpose marine cadaster, which is the BOEM's data portal. Next slide, please. So now we're going to get into some of the concerns that we hear at previous meetings through public notice and comment, and where we are with some of these issues. So one of the concerns, obviously, is navigation and regarding radar performance. Radar will continue to function within a wind wind facility. However, what the issue is that there may be so many targets that you may not be able to identify something that you really need to be concerned with, because there's going to be several targets on your radar, and you may be. Becomes more easy to be distracted by the other items that are showing up on your radar, but your radar will actually continue to function there. Obstruction marking, per Coast Guard regulations, all the facilities will be marked and charted.
A question: where this is new on the Coast Guard marking thing, where there haven't been any wind columns out there. Do they have things in their regulations to deal with something that never existed before?
Well, yeah, actually, my next slide. This is an example in Kapiti Bay of an underwater turbine that was the first grid interconnected underwater turbine. And you can see it's right here. It's a small demonstration facility. I think it's two turbines. And you see how it's marked. This is the cable to shore, the transmission cable, and the facility's right here. And this is how it's marked. And the Coast Guard required some markings, because it's underwater, some markings with buoys. But even in this case, there was no regulatory exclusion zone placed around it. It was just a notice to mariners. You can see down here, vessels entering and departing should avoid anchoring or fishing in that particular area, but there's no regulatory system and avoidance of the chart. And so that's an example of another, really the only Atlantic anyway, renewable energy facility that's been put in place, and what Coast Guard's procedure has been on that. We are working with Coast Guard and other folks on how, what lighting techniques to how to mark the towers and the colors and all that kind of thing. That's a partly evolving process. There's some requirements that they have to do, but I think, to make sure that it's visible, but also perhaps not attracting to other species. Okay, next slide, please. So regarding search and rescue, this is more on a larger commercial scale facility than what would be in a demonstration scale facility as what's proposed off of Maine right now. But, you know, U.S. Coast Guard has indicated that search and rescue operations would not be hindered, mostly based upon the Cape Wind energy assessment. And they have requirements in the Cape Wind facility to be able to call for an immediate shutdown of that facility if search and rescue need arises, and there's no indication that that would change from one wind energy facility to another. In the example of Cape Wind, they are required to have a control center monitored 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and as I mentioned, they have to be able to shut down the turbines within 2 minutes of notification by the Coast Guard. So I talked a little bit. Next slide, please. So I talked a little bit about the safety exclusion zones, which are a large concern. The Coast Guard has laid out a process by which a developer may request an exclusion zone, and they have to do a navigational risk assessment associated with that if they would want to exclude any type of activity around the facility. For fixed monopile or tripod foundations, there's been no indication that they intend to have any exclusionary zones around them. There may be, and likely would be, a different situation on a floating turbine structure where you may have catenary cables or tension-like cables that expand perhaps a great deal around from where the actual monopile turbine is located, the transition piece. But that's yet to be seen. We haven't seen what specific technology I think is going to occur up in for this demonstration project off of Maine. Likely, and once again, you know, regarding tie-ups and that type of thing, is private property, so that type of thing would not be authorized by the property owner. The only example of exclusion zones that they do have is on a few oil and gas rigs in the Gulf of Mexico. I think it was like 7 out of 3,000 platforms have exclusion zones in the Gulf of Mexico. So here's an example of just a typical turbine arrangement where you have, depending on the size of the turbine, separation distance would increase. Deep water, so you have between 3.3 and 0.6 nautical miles apart, a height of 65 to 130 feet off the mean high tide. Examples off of Block Island and off of Rhode Island is 804 meters apart between turbines. Cape Wind Energy Project is 629 meters between turbines on a row and 1,000 meters on a column. And then another demonstration project off of New Jersey is Fisherman's Energy with 1,080 meters between turbines. Next slide, please. So once again, this is based upon a fixed monopile design. This is a slide from Deepwater Wind and their Block Island Wind Farm proposal, with showing a vessel with a 300-foot door spread going between these 804-meter apart turbines. Next slide, please. Once again, just an aerial view of what that particular facility would look like. Next slide, please. Another issue that it is definitely raised is electromagnetic fields. We have conducted, there's one DOE, the Department of Energy has funded a lab-based study that is continuing to be ongoing. They imported, American lobster to the facility to actually have them look at reactions to them and all the preliminary results. They just started that process, I think, in this winter. And the early indications are that there's, you know, it's not any large indication of behavioral changes from the lobster in these lab tank-based studies. But it's hard to discern a lot of times what, you know, when you put an animal in a tank, you know, what is a behavioral reaction from not being in a tank and being in the offer environment. So there's a lot of drawbacks of lab-based study. I think they're primarily trying to look at, real, so they have to do several control studies to try to discern if it's a result of being in the tank that's causing the change or the EMF itself, themselves. And thus far, there has been no statistically significant differences in any of the controls, not just with lobster, but with halibut, and they did a Dungeness crab, and they have some West Coast species as well.
Question here.
Sure.
Oh, now, what size fields are we talking about? How does that differ in water versus on land? And, how does some of these, I know this is something that people are concerned about, so how do some of those things differ between what the impacts that?
First off, all the cables are shielded. So so there's no direct electromagnetic field because of the shielding, but what it's called, it's indirect field that's produced even with the shielding. We haven't really done it. There have been some studies as to document what that level is, but I don't have a direct comparison as to what it would be like on a transmission tower system on land versus what it would be on the ground. I think the we do have some reports available on our website that describe that. I just don't remember. I would encourage you to go to our environmental studies page. We have a pretty good summary of what's known out there already. So there's also an ongoing in situ study going off in Santa Barbara Channel in California. And so far, they have an active cable and a non-active cable going through Santa Barbara Channel, and they've been doing monitoring of these two cables, and they have not found any significant differences in how species there are reacting around the energized cable versus the non-energized cable. And we expect that report next year. And I think based upon how successful that is, we're looking to try to do something similar on the Atlantic coast as well. So we have begun preliminary designs on trying to figure out where we can do a similar type of study or controlled study in situ on the Atlantic coast.
So are you talking about whales and dolphins as well?
The lab-based ones, obviously not. But if there's no way to really control if a whale or a sea turtle is in that area. So if they swim by, that would be great. while the monitoring program is occurring.
You're not herding them in.
No.
Okay.
The study that we have available on our website does talk about the differences between cetaceans and sea turtles and how they perceive electromagnetic fields in the Earth's environment. Generally, sea turtles are more magnetically sensitive to those things, as opposed to the electrosensitive of shark species. To the extent that the fields produced by these cables, they can be perceived, but whether there's no indication of any behavioral change that would necessarily occur over long periods, they may sense it, realize it's nothing, and then move along from that encounter. So here's an example. Next slide is just an example of really the only construction operations we have received thus far. This is the Cape Wind Energy Project. This just gives you an idea of a full commercial scale facility. And this is a diagram of how the turbines, it's about 130 turbines, will be interconnected in that facility. And the large black line here, this is the export cable to shore, and in the middle of the entire facility is an electric service platform where everything ties in, and that's where I think they plan on putting a helipad on there as well to help facilitate any, well, not only maintenance of the facility, but any sort of any rescue operations that may have to occur in the air as well.
So are all these interconnecting cables, and they're all buried cables?
Yes. I mean, they will be where feasible. I mean, there may be some areas where also they had saw bedrock, and there's other technologies that may, you know, be mitigated, such as concrete mats and that type of thing.
And in the case of Stato, we changed the technology drastically.
Yes.
So the first question that brings me to mind is, why is Stato out here? Because they're the only ones in the world that have any working knowledge of that technology that we're going to discuss about.
Right.
Why wouldn't have they been invited?
They were invited, and I thought they were supposed to. I think they did RSVP, so I'm not sure why they weren't able to make it here today. But the idea of these workshops is to have both industries, fishing industry and the offshore water industry here. So
if we have a floating turbine, when it's not a, we can't have any. There's got to be some non-buried cable.
Right, between where, obviously it has to make seabed contact eventually.
Right.
But for, you know, between the base of the spar and when it first makes contact with the seabed, it would be buried. It would be exposed.
We don't have any.
We received an application, but we have a general conceptual plan, but it's not until we receive the actual construction operations plan where we know, you know, what design they actually intend to utilize moving forward. Next slide, please. So regarding another issue that is raised is regarding financial compensation. There is a lot of people that are familiar with the oil and gas program where there is a financial compensation that the industry does pay into a fund that's facilitated by the National Marine Fisheries Service. If there is a gear loss, they're able to apply for gear compensation in the oil and gas program. And unfortunately, in our Congress did not give us that direct authority. Energy Policy Act of 2005.
Would BOEM support that if establishing such a fund if legislators change their mind?
Well, if legislators change their mind, then...
Well, you'll have to, I guess.
We would. Okay. Of course we would. There are other opportunities. Just because that specific, congressional directive doesn't exist, that doesn't mean that, applying for other state authorizations or as part of just the normal process of engagement there isn't a financial compensation. There isn't that ability to have financial compensation. Mm-hmm. And, BOEM is not going to discourage that in any way, but we just don't have that statutory authority like we do in the oil and gas program. So the issue of damage liability is a large issue, I think, in folks' minds, and one that we're trying to work closely in identifying what the issues are and what BOEM's role can be in reducing that risk. There's some examples on the West Coast of the Oregon Fishing Cable Committees with the telecommunications companies to establish basically a working group so that everybody's aware of where cables are and basically signing waivers so that, if they do encounter a cable that, they can gear in place, they'll be compensated for the gear and that type of thing. So there's existing examples of, private partnerships to be able to address these issues. And we've all this wants to encourage that type of agreement if it's feasible on the Atlantic. It's not telecommunications companies, it's a little it's a little different field, but I think there are some models that can be followed on the Atlantic Coast. So where are we right now with our best management practices? The BMPs are the planning measures and construction techniques and operational procedures to reduce potential adverse impacts. And the mitigation measures I think of more as the very project-specific, preventative or corrective, or even compensatory actions to reduce impacts. The best management practices we have in the books now were identified in 2007, and there are the large environmental impact statement that we did for our entire program nationally. And we do have the regulations, if you want to look them up there, state that a lessee must demonstrate the use of these best management practices in their plans. So that's the hook. That's the regulatory hook that we have to say, you know, what we're doing now. You know, we have an example, I think, here next. Next slide, please. Of what they are. And they're very broad. And this gets us to why, in the purpose of these meetings, they require cooperation with fishing interests to reduce conflict. Now, what we're trying to do is really dig deeper into how that should look. You know, when we're reviewing a plan, what does it look like when, you know, they said they cooperated with fishing interests to reduce conflict? Does that mean they maybe hired a liaison and had one meeting and that box is checked and they're all done? Or does it need to be something more specific? So I think this is where we really like your input on, you know, what is adequate and you know, how do you see this type of best management practice being implemented. Also, the notification requirements, a lot of these are pretty simple and obviously a lot of them are even already required by other statutes or by another federal agency. Obviously, reducing marine debris, proper marking, and cable barrel inspection. I think the inspection issue is something that has been raised. When would fishermen like to be notified when they're, you know, actually after a large storm? When are they going to go out and inspect the cables to make sure that they are adequately still buried? And how that notification process should look and feel, and how often that inspection should take place?
I don't know if it's appropriate, but the company at work was very heavy into the ROVs and some factors around the bottom of the ocean, all this kind of stuff that already did. We're very interested in that inspection. And it's one of these subjects that gets mentioned, but not a lot said about it. And here you're talking roughly 6-foot burial. But what's the minimum? I mean, what I'm trying to get to is there a way for companies, ours and others, to somehow connect with BOEM on how we might solve this inspection problem. To know that that cable is, if it's buried at 6, do you have to do something when it's 3 or 2? Or, you know, what I'm talking about, put some meat and potatoes with that inspection requirement. You know, so people like us can design equipment if we need to be able to do what you folks, whatever, determine needs to be done.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's a good point. Yeah, I think that's definitely something that the way it's written currently is that you must inspect to make sure it's buried. But you have areas in some places where you have sand waves that may increase or decrease, so the actual depth that it's buried, you know, could fluctuate with that moving sand wave. So I think getting into methodologies and what we're actually looking for is something. BOEM is very interested in pursuing. So, either through, input back from the fishermen on what they'd like to see, or directly with the industry coming to BOEM and wanting to raise this issue, I think are both appropriate means by which to do that.
Some combination of
the two.
I just wanted to say, many of your questions have been very good at sort of probing at specific issues either to Maine or, in this case, sort of getting at some of the specifics of potential mitigation measures that we'll be covering in a small group. So just in the interest of time, I could ask, if you've got a really important clarifying question about something Brian is saying, have at it. But if we could hold the other questions that are sort of digging into the meat of small groups until after, that would be helpful.
Yeah, and I'm almost done. So anyway, these are kind of what the current best management practices are, or what they are. So once again, just we need to really dig into those. So some current mitigation strategies that have been identified, and this is a report that's available on our website that was done completed this year or in 2012. Identified several different mitigation strategies that were in use in Europe and other places, and they involve a lot of the same issues that I raised here. I got a question before about what's a guardship in the UK, for example. For certain activities, like where they're doing actual construction or cable burial, and they don't want traffic going through that area, there's been cases where they've actually hired local fishing vessels to be guard ships to prevent any disturbance while they're actually doing the different construction phases. But I think that all the rest of them are pretty self-explanatory.
Is there any more? I'm a little bit amazed at the word conflict when you on your first one. And conflict is such a broad.
Oh, it is. I think it's just been the first thing everybody wants to do when they're going in is to try to find some place that you have the least amount of conflict, and so that's obviously the first thing I think people try to do. So it is very. That's a broad term.
That could be economic conflict or gear conflict. I mean, it could be so wide of a range of things.
That's what you're here to help us define.
I know. Is it written somewhere in a more defined?
I think if you look at that report, it does go into a little more detail and a little more description of each of these mitigation strategies. Next slide, please. So once again, I already mentioned our ongoing electromagnetic field studies. We've also had a workshop looking at fish acoustics, what levels are fish and other invertebrates impacted by construction activities. Those are ongoing. We just actually this week had a meeting. We flew in several Europeans to talk about benthic habitat impacts and what their experiences were with 7 years in the UK now and 10 years off of the North Sea. What they're seeing on the ground, and that was actually a very informative session that we had with them. And that the results of that workshop will be available on our website as well. But generally speaking, one of my take-home messages was talk about fixed platforms, which is what's being used in the all these other facilities. You do see some. Colonization around the foundations, but it tends to be within 50 meters of the foundation, and then beyond that, the normal substrate is unchanged. And that includes even the scour depressions as well. Next slide. So socioeconomic, these 8 workshops, the first step in really trying to identify and flesh out some of these best management practices and mitigation measures. We have an interagency agreement with NIMS to evaluate the socioeconomic impact of fishing, and that's Justin is here representing that team. And then we also, as I mentioned, the space use conflict and mitigation measure report that was recently completed and is available on our website. So just lastly, when we have opportunities for input, we come up, this is now I think the third or fourth year we've been to the forum. We try to make ourselves available to both informally and formally. But formally, we do publish notices in the Federal Register requesting for interest in the area, calls for information, and also notice of intent to prepare environmental documents when we get to that point. Next slide. This is the informal measures as well. I was actually just at the United States Marine Fisheries Commission meeting. Is that still February, right? Yeah. So earlier this month, down in Alexandria, where I addressed the Interstate Fishery Management Board, talking about a lot of the issues that face them that may not be council issues as a part of where we are in the process and what studies we intend to do. And that's it for my presentation.
But I, for people that aren't able to be here today to provide input into these topics that could be reflected in the report you guys put together, or do you use consideration to your way?
I mean, absolutely. When we, we will, like I said, our intention right now is when we have the draft report available, we will post that and let people know if they have additional comments that they want to add, or there's things in there that they feel were not captured. We also have the opportunity to do that when we post the minutes, usually within a few weeks after each meeting, we post the minutes of the meeting. They're very broad at that point. But absolutely, if you have things, not only the folks in this room, but other individuals as well, have information they want to provide, we'll take that into consideration.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you, everybody. And before we move on, I want to just do a couple things. One is to welcome the folks who have come in since we began, and the second is to sort of review just very briefly where we're headed next in the meeting, so folks can orient themselves if they weren't able to get here when it began. So let me do the second thing first, in case any more folks come in. So we're here till about 11:45. We started this morning with an overview presentation from Brian Hooker at Bureau of Ocean Energy Management that really sets the context of the energy siting process. The context of these workshops, this is the eighth of eight, so the last in a series along the Atlantic coast, essentially bringing together interested parties from commercial and recreational fishing industries and from the wind development industry to really have a chance to talk together about how to reduce the conflicts that may occur between those two industries out in the ocean. So those may have to do with navigation, reliability, or environmental impact, this whole series of categories. And the purpose of these meetings is to really sort of generate ideas through conversation among those industries and have the Bureau here to sort of bounce questions off. So we began with a presentation from Brian, and thank you for that, and thank you all for your good questions. What we're going to do for the rest of the meeting is essentially break out into small discussion groups where the first one, we will benefit from the material, the input that's been generated at previous meetings, and have a look at the list of and the categories of issues and concerns about fishing and wind energy interactions, and add to that. Basically, have a chance to review it, discuss it among yourselves, think up something new that hasn't been raised before, or expound on something that has been raised before. So basically get your input on the issues and concerns. And then after a short break, we reconvene into those small groups and really focus on the solution side of things. So some folks here in their questions during the presentation to Brian had already begun thinking about, well, for example, cable inspection. It isn't satisfactory or sufficient to just say the cables will be inspected. Sort of what kind of meat can you put on those bones? So very interested in getting your ideas, suggestions, and input on that. So with that, let me invite the folks who have come in to just briefly introduce yourself.
Sure. Sarah Cottmar, the Department of Marine Resources. I apologize, coming in at 9, it said 9 online and in the book, so I apologize.
Yeah, that just got brought to our attention. Our apologies. I think a little cross-communication of signals there. So, welcome.
Kathleen Reardon, also from DMR.
Nathan Johnson from Ocean Renewable Power Company, Portland.
Dana Hannon, Fish Festival Coley. I'm the one doing the bird survey for Tetra Tech.
Rob Ulin, also Fish Festival Katie Sarah.
Vincent Baldano, commercial fisherman in Portland, New England Fisheries Management Council.
And Ben
Leary.
The question is, do we have everybody else reintroduce themselves? I think we'll allow some minor reintroductions at the small group table. So welcome everybody. What we're going to do now is sort ourselves into Let me see if it's three or two.
Three?
Yes. All right, let's sort ourselves into three small tables, and I'm going to suggest that obviously we cluster around this already populated one, then this one, and then this one, so that we can, and don't worry about what table you're sitting at. It isn't a popularity contest. We really just want to sort of get each table at roughly the same number of people, four or five people at each table. And each table will have a facilitator and a note taker, and they'll review your sort of your charge for this first 20 or 30 minute discussion. But again, now we want to get the benefit of your insight and input into helping further define some of the issues or problems that you see, either as a wind developer, a cable person, a commercial fisherman of any gear type, fisherman, whatever it happens to be, just want to get your concerns on the table. So if you could, try to sort yourselves into three tables of roughly the same number, at this one, and this one.
I'd love to have a fisherman at my table. I'm inviting somebody that actually pulls traps to join my table.
Okay, push
How
button.
Are you doing?
Well,
okay, push
button.
Good to see you. Bill Dawg from
Ed. Come on down. Pull a Bob Barker.
Bob Barker, is that the...
Come on down.
That's not the
you're
whale
yourself.
Bob Barker, is it?
No. Bob Barker as in the
the real site. Bob Barker.
Yeah. The Bob Barker's a Barker.
As in the
not the one
MC for the Miss America contest.
Anybody want a cup of coffee or anything before we get going?
And here, the Bridget Bardot was one of that little boat there.
Here's something you can just start glancing at. These are the subject. And we'll be handing out a separate one when we get around to the specific mitigation. These are the ones we want to start looking at first. These are the subject areas and some of the ideas that have come up in previous meetings. There it is right there. Wait. Here it's this one. It's on the back side of that one. On how they handle the mouth.
Yeah, I didn't get one of those.
Yeah, that's the one.
All right.
Grab a cup of coffee. You might need anything else?
I'm sorry, thanks. Richard, you're a lobster man, right? Yeah. Okay. You said you were a lobster man,
yeah.
Right? Okay. Where do you fish out of?
Frencher.
Frencher? Oh.
What do you do?
I'm with the Northeast Fishery Science Center. I'm an economist, and I'm the team leader for the Sociocultural Economic Impacts Project. And I drove all this way to try to get to the table with some lobstermen. So, you're my guy.
So you were down in Woods Hole area?
Yep. Yeah, I'm in Woods Hole.
Okay. I went down there with GMRI has a MREP course of the Marine Resource Education Program.
Yeah.
And I went
Richard Dave Trent,
the Bigelow.
Oh, okay.
Discussions with science.
Yeah. Is that a good experience?
That was excellent. That whole program was really good.
That's good. It's nice that we're opening up and bringing people in.
Yeah, they have two other sessions that are all, one's all fish science and one's fisheries management.
Okay.
And then they have that one that goes to Woods Hole.
Yeah.
I am. Yeah. Right down the street. For once, I didn't have to travel.
They're big on pushing their new net shop.
Where were you coming up?
Yeah. I've been reading about what they're working on.
Oh, wow. Yeah, not a
whatever that was called. Gate.
Yeah, the albatross in Delaware or whatever it was. Yeah.
That image on that.
Yeah, I guess we have some making up to do.
It was all good to see all that.
That's good. I actually signed up for a survey cruise for late March, early April, so I'm going out for 14 days on the Bigelow.
Yeah,
so I'm looking forward to that.
We're a nonprofit, and we've been around for about 30 years.
How far is the Stadoil lease area? How far is that from like your home port, your hailing port?
Well, it's in the next. We're in the next lobster zone.
Okay.
I'm in zone D.
Yeah. Come on out.
Where do they want to put it? Where are they talking about putting rates to run separately?
Well, it's kind of, it's off of, they describe it as basically the pool space.
You did? Okay, cool.
But
just making sure.
It's going to go out to the water.
No, we're right in Rockland.
It's more from friendship. It was been more of a dragging area, for like shrimp toes and things like that, more than a lobstering area. Lobstering would be more.
Community organizing policy.
Probably more of the locales, a little bit closer.
And some energy, more technical energy.
But, I mean, from like some of these, the Mid-Coast Fishermen's Association, the draggers from Port Clyde would be in that area, and anybody who would be shrimping and stuff from Friendship or things like that would be in that area. So.
Well, here's what we're going to do, folks. I'm Dave.
How you doing?
Nathan Johnson. So what we're going to do, this is 8 of 8. So it seems like we might have beat this horse to death, but it seems like every time we think that, people come up with some new ideas or expand on the stuff we've already done. So basically this one handout, which says previously identified offshore wind development concerns. Let's take about 5-10 minutes. We'll just look through it, because basically we've got big picture headings in here. And the way I've been looking at it, as we develop these things, you might as well start thinking of the next step. We're talking about what could be some of the management practices and mitigations. But for now, if anything glaringly you go, hey, how come they haven't even thought of this? You know, we make that a list. But then, if not, just kind of look at what we've got in here, and we'll have another handout. Right?
Yeah, we'll do that for the next session.
It's a lot more detailed on some of the ideas right now for BMPs. And, I mean, these are, like, everywhere. It's the gamut. So don't think, that's really... Some of the ideas are like, okay, they can be real project-specific. And I don't think it's a bad idea to think of that now, because it's probably down the road it's going to have to be considered. But just remember, this is sort of like the development phase. So, like, you know, you're going to... Not are you going to go over ledge, you know, Walter's Ledge or something. More, how are you going to put in a cable under you know, hard bottom conditions or something like that, you know. If you got ideas on how to do that, hey, we're all for that too. But so basically, if we just kind of go through here, I think it's a good time for us just discuss. Like, you look at something, you say, hey, let's don't make it formal at all.
Okay.
Let's just, like,
under the siting process, what does WEA stand for?
Those energy area. Yeah, those are the ones that he showed.
Yeah, behind there.
Yeah. So those are the ones that he developed. Yeah.
So have you seen this? Brian was talking about it, that we put together last year. We've done a lot of stuff to compile. This was another, like, 30-page one that we did.
I saw this right at the beginning. Yeah, when we first started this process.
Yeah. So we've done a lot to compile.
Yeah. Those the minutes from there.
Questions and everything. So.
This is good. This is good. Can I keep this one?
Sure. Cool. And then there's that, too. So that was about a year ago.
Okay.
It's a... like a 30-page chapter for environmental stakeholders, their questions and concerns.
Right. And like Brian said, a lot of this is expanding on you guys and what they did in New Bedford, Massachusetts, and Rhode Island.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is kind of like,
we're actually
not reinventing the wheel.
Exactly, that's why I wanted to.
But it's more of a federal.
Yeah, and a lot of those have been, they're all reflected.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that, because what I'm doing now, that's
the actual area is not changed.
So I'm going to be talking about
the
historical.
Yeah.
Information that's got us to this
area.
So that'll come in.
Good.
We'll
like I made a whole list. These weren't on there, even though I know I've seen these.
Great.
It's hard to find certain things.
Yeah, you don't know where to go.
Yeah, I'm on the
Our own staff has that.
Yeah.
How's the...
Anyway, well, that might be a good point, Suzanne, since you've already done it. Is there any on here that we're missing?
I haven't gotten through them all just
okay.
yet.
Yeah,
what is it? And what's important too, I think, in some areas that are, you know, specific to Maine, there may be some things that we just don't have addressed on here.
I think the biggest thing is the technology.
We run into that all the time. We've never been in. I mean, the kind of an interesting story. I can't say that I'm not immediately bothered because we don't have fishermen. Then here we don't have fishermen, and neither are here to speak of.
Yeah, but it's
we have the fishermen, the two other guys who wanted in, who are also part of other reasons, you know, other entities.
So that makes it easy.
Besides fishing,
but
why,
still, it's an education process for
everybody. And it seems to be a complete bust as far as contacting or getting fishermen.
We invited them, and people responded saying they were coming.
Really?
And, yeah, we actually were going to have a fairly good turnout for that.
I'm thinking about going to get
when I say that, I've been in this stuff long enough and been the only one at enough meetings to know that it's not necessarily your fault. And I'm not saying
that. Yeah, we definitely invited them, believe me.
It's just going more than just inviting people.
What do you mean, who did you invite? Ocean Stat Oil. We had a whole list of other developers.
I don't remember off the top of my head right now.
We've had Atlantic Wind Connection.
How about fishermen?
We have a long list of fishermen from the Northeast Fisheries Management Council. We talked to the MDMR folks.
So the Northeast Fisheries Council, is that all fishermen?
Fishery Management Council. Oh, so they have their stakeholder outreach list of people that they reach out to when they have public meetings and people that want to be contacted and like to participate in meetings. So this was more of a participatory meeting. It wasn't supposed to be an out free for all, you know, whoever wants to come. People that really want to sit down and talk about stuff and just, you know, really work at stuff and not just everybody. So we invited, our list was about, for this meeting, I want to say about 80 people, maybe 90. And we got a response about 30. We're going to show up definitely. And actually, the state government folks actually suggested that we tack on this workshop to the Fishermen's Forum so that it would be more accessible to fishermen and that, like, people, when people most likely are not out fishing, you know, in winter and all that stuff. So we actually talked to folks from Stat Oil ahead of time as well. And you know, told them about this meeting, asked them what their thoughts were, what we should do, and invited them to come as well.
So we've had those people. I'm just thinking. You're going to get more fishermen.
I feel like we're talking the same thing. There were a bunch of misconnections, though. Whatever it was, confusion, because the way that it was labeled, a lot of it is like you guys reach out to people, but then it's sort of like the next step. I think there was a disconnect. So most of the fishermen that would want to be a part of this conversation are looking at the Fishermen Forum materials where it was labeled as private until Friday.
Right, which we didn't know. I mean,
yeah, but that's a big reason why. So, I mean,
which is hard.
It's really important to...
Not us.
So we don't need to worry. We don't need to point fingers, but I think the fact of the matter is that it's great to do something at the forum because it is when people are around, but when there's miscommunication about what time it starts or who's able to come, then it's not surprising that people are, that the word's not going to be spread out. And I think that there was confusion about who, like, is this a really targeted thing? It seems private because we could have done a lot more to spread the word, put it in our newspapers. I mean, and I think there's a concern to spread the net too far because you don't want everybody and their mother coming, but Maine's a really small place, and I think most people see an event like this and they understand who it's for.
Right.
So I think, I mean, I think it's always a struggle, but things like that were on the more local level where people are looking at the forum website and that information wasn't there. They're going to look to BOEM and say, well, this was a private thing. They didn't want us to be here. So obviously that's not anybody's intent, but that's what ends up happening.
Because we had communicated with them like months ago and that's when we scheduled.
Yeah, we started talking about this at the
time. So things are going to fall follow up on how that stuff
went. Well, we did as much as possible.
Well, I told Brian about it. It wasn't, Brian, and then
it wasn't something scheduled opposite.
Well, anyway,
the website is private.
It's in the printed thing as private as well. So.
And the times are wrong. We had scheduled those times, I mean, back in the day.
Well, we've got places and not even had our rooms when we had already scheduled rooms.
So there's only so much we can do, but we're here now.
Yeah,
and
so
let's
we are at a table with someone from a power company and someone who pulls traps.
Let's try and look at this a little bit.
Section by section and see if there's particular.
Yeah, let's do. That's a good
whatever
idea.
They suggest.
And are you, that sounds like a wonderful idea.
I'm a poet. One of the things that I was going to say in this first section that we've heard a lot is there's always the question of exclusion and who enforces it. I think just to try to clarify that, I know in Maine the discussion has been a lot about if it's in the developer's court to set those exclusion zones or if it's within the Coast Guard. And I know we've heard a lot saying that the Coast Guard isn't going to do anything. But then, you know, several years ago there was a discussion in Maine at the state level about a developer's insurance company is going to come up with this distance. So I think there's been a little bit of a misconception about who decides what the exclusion zone is and who enforces it. So you've got the who enforces piece, but I think it's who decides
maybe
the distance.
Yeah. He might have some first-hand.
I could tell you lots. I probably won't tell you all the stories about the process about working with the Coast Guard, but yeah, the Coast Guard went through a whole public process for our site, which is a tidal energy site here in Port, in state waters, and including several public hearings with the town of Lubeck and city of Eastport, where the fishermen wanted a regulated area around our site, which surprised a lot of people. The Coast Guard took that into consideration and said, no, we're not going to write that. So it's a cautionary area marked on the charts. I came in late, but I think Brian's put the chart up that has our markings. You know, so we as part of our FERC application process, which is a little different than Bowen, you know, we have to submit a navigational safety plan, and so that includes, and then actually once we got our license, we had to update it based on the PATONS, which is the preliminary aids to navigation, which is the marking buoys, and everything for us is new for the whole industry and for the Coast Guard. So the Coast Guard had to send it up the chain because they were cautious about setting precedents.
Well, they took it to figure out who was going to regulate the industry.
It's a setback or anything.
No.
And who's doing that? Okay.
We wanted to.
Who's making
this? Is crazy. And I have a background. I actually held my lobster license for over 10 years. My family was a fisherman industry. So they actually had an interesting thought on the markings, too, where we have a number of turbines proposed within a zone. And they wanted to put a single navigation in the middle of the zone versus having the whole zone marked, which is the way we wanted it, the way the fishermen wanted it, so they knew where the boundary was, they could drag the line.
Yeah.
And the Coast Guard said, well, we actually would prefer a single buoy in the middle, and they had actually backtracked off that, and so we have four marker buoys around the thing. And then the cable is marked as any new cable would be marked.
They think zone maintenance.
Well, actually, no. Their concern was putting additional markers in would potentially inhibit navigation.
Or more.
So it's their waterways division. So if you put more markers in the water, it's actually additional devices.
Watching a lot of people navigate, it also confuses people.
Yeah, one more thing is
there's a lot of recreational boaters who come up to things that they don't know which side to go on.
The thing that is,
ones to go between.
There's certainly a lot of applicabilities to what we have done in offshore wind. There's a lot of differences as well. But, you know, in working with a fisherman, we work with a fisherman very early on, and they actually helped to site our project because the resource we're going after is not necessarily the most safe for the best area to fish because of the high velocities. Certainly not fixed gear. But so we worked with the mobile guys, you know, the bottom, because there's a very healthy scallop, I should say, very active scallop industry in Hobson Bay. It's the most active in Maine, anyways. And so you actually get a lot of vessels coming from away.
Right.
There's about 140 vessels that fish that area during scallop season.
You would be a good source for this, you know, and we've talked to several of the wind developers on the communication plans. Obviously, one of the things is, you know, develop a communication plan or, you know, interactions between user groups and stuff. I mean, you could probably, you know, give us details when we get into that part, and you know, how to because I mean, you think about it, this, you know, like one statement. You know, engage fishermen or engage users. That's easy to say, but it's like, you know, and like you said, every group would be different. And we've been beating that one around.
Yeah, every fishery is a little different. And then, you know, we've got a notice of mariners that goes out.
Exactly.
Coast Guard. So that's one way to do it. We also do it locally on the street. You know, but the boats were away, which is what you're going to get offshore wind too. You're going to get some guys that are coming into the area. Those are the most problematic.
Mm-hmm.
And then the outliers, because the vast majority of the fishermen are considerate and understand what is going on. But there's a few outliers that are not going to be that way, just like in everything else. And
those so have you had gear in your...
We've had issue with one vessel 3 times, and then the other vessels we have not had any issues.
Is that some local?
That was just Dragon. Scallop?
Not extremely local to the Eastport area. But there's also an urchin fishery. There's urchin draggers up there. There's a couple of pickle boats, but it's mostly sculpin. So,
I mean, I fish it a little bit, not near tidal areas, and sometimes, you know, you set traps, and after a storm they end up, three-quarters of a mile away or something.
there's very little fixed gear there.
There's just far enough away most of
the time. And the tidal stream is so... So it's 5.5
current. I hate to interrupt, but let's try to stick back with our list here. You guys can do side conversation.
Sure.
I was just going to say about the exclusion piece, Nate. I think that for tomorrow's session, that's a really useful thing for you to be able to speak to how that worked for you guys.
Yeah.
I think that's
so it's actually ours is not an exclusion zone. It's a safety zone, cautionary area. Where they discourage any anchoring or diving or anything.
And is your equipment insured by a private insurance company? And they haven't made any demands.
Okay, well, I think we're going basically from the exclusion zones into the regulations. That's a good segue. Because these are some of the ideas. Because a lot of people, you know, what regulations are going to be directed at the fishing industry or at the wind industry that could affect fishermen. You know, so like I say, there's going to be more of these. You're going to see in the next handout when there's specific ideas on BMPs and mitigation measures. I've been getting into a lot of the mitigation issues and trying to look at all different sources of information, and I'm finding out that what we're going to develop, I think, most out of this is BMPs, because the mitigations are going to be very project specific in a lot of cases. And, you know, so because these are going to be more like, you know, cables must be this, you know, you must do this when it comes to scour, you know, prevention and stuff like that, you know. And so, you know, it's funny, we call this mitigations, but I see it more as BMPs. And
it was confusing for me to read that picture. I thought there'd be something more like a, more to do with economics.
Or
community benefit agreement thing.
Well, that's where it's a project specific issue where BOEM in many cases can enhance, like you said, they can encourage it, but it's not really their position to say you're going to go out and talk to the community, you're going to evaluate the resource this way, and you're going to compensate this way.
Why not?
Because he said that was in. They aren't directed by federal law.
By Congress.
Law.
Yeah, so if Congress tells them to do it, they would do it. They only do what Congress tells them to do.
Right.
So Congress doesn't currently.
But what he didn't say necessarily was that in Massachusetts and Rhode Island they have an agreement. Between fishermen and
the
developers.
Right. I was involved in that. It's not directed by regulation.
Okay, but isn't it still best management practice? Wouldn't it still be considered best management practice?
No. Best management practices are typically driven by construction methods and operation methods and what's going on when you're building it, when you're operating it, when you're
But what does that have to do with the people and the fish?
Because it'll, I mean, it'll affect how each one of those processes affect them. But it's not a monetary thing, and the federal government hardly ever gets into it. What you're talking about in Massachusetts was actually driven by the water quality certification that in Massachusetts DEP required of that contractor for Neptune. So that wasn't a federal thing. Even though some of it's in federal water.
But, that goes back to my question about if you're required as best management practice to reduce conflict, and you think that the economics of this thing is a major conflict, then you're required to reduce that conflict. That's why I asked them if there was any more defining terminology involved.
Well, and I think what it's getting down to, you know, you start splitting hairs on what's conflict. It's like, I was involved in the Neptune LNG project, and I'll tell you, it came down to meeting after meeting after meeting after meeting with the fishermen, identifying the resource, identifying what was going to be lost from you know, income as a result of building this project. So it was so site-specific that it really didn't lend itself to the actual construction activities, the operation activities, things like that. It was kind of foreign to that. It was more of a socioeconomic issue between the proponent and the people that are using that resource. You know, and I don't know how Boeing got to the point. I mean, it's all driven, like you say, by the Congress and what they decide they want that agency to do. Because I'm from the Gulf, and a lot of it's driven by regulations down there. And oil and gas, it's really strange how, you know, we're just evolving. I think the wind energy issues are evolving.
I would say if we're on to communication.
Sure, let's just keep going.
I think,
and just as a heads up, we have about 5 more minutes of this discussion and move on.
All right.
But please,
I think, you know, Nate's company has done a great job with all of this here in Maine, and I think obviously these plants need to be really locally relevant. And so one plant that might work in Florida might not work here. So, but at the same time, I think it's great to have some guidance about some of these best practices. We've spent some time looking at some of the agreements between fishermen and the oil and gas companies in Alaska and some of the agreements that they have around communications and shared use. And so I think, you know, it looks like that would obviously be what Boeing is thinking about doing with all of these points, is putting forth some ideas so that a developer can enter into some sort of a MOU, or it doesn't need to be formal, but just sort of have, I think having that out in the open and as here's what we're all going to try to do, memorandum of understanding. I was going to, you know, it's not like you have to sign a formal agreement, but I think if Boeing can help provide some ideas, then I think it's up to each local community and the developer to figure out on that communication piece.
And that's exactly the idea. I think you're right, Susan. Because everything I've looked at from the UK, everywhere, it's like, you know, in your communication plan, A, B, C, D, E, it doesn't say you've got to have X number of meetings. It says you should engage them in specific to the project. You're exactly right.
And I think this is a really good point, like just this whole discussion that's been brought up at other meetings, is what about what's outside of the Boeing process? That's also really important. And how does that not fall away and be addressed? I mean, that's a really, you know, legitimate concern, because there's all these issues that doesn't fall under NEPA or doesn't fall under the rest of that. So, yeah, that's a good point.
How about any of these as a zip through siting process?
I mean, there's a big, I think that your questions were so right on, is that to have a slide that starts with WEAs and come to Maine, that's just going to confuse everybody here. Nobody knows what that means because we didn't do it. And I think from what we've heard from a lot of fishermen is there's a lot of frustration that we didn't do it. And that, you know, there are a lot of people who wanted to have this be more thoughtful and have more planning involved, but our state level, our state part of the task force didn't push to do that. So I think it's important for that to be clear here when we come to Maine, aside from the best management practices, just talking to people in Maine, it's really confusing. But
that's
also,
because I mean,
those are slides that you use everywhere,
heard that,
but it doesn't.
Anywhere else.
Well, because you haven't had that issue anywhere that's
right
in Maine.
Right. I stated in my introduction that I was involved in marine spectral planning and following that regional planning body. That's solely out of my beginning involvement in this wind project. Is realizing that these states are in this mad rush to outdo each other, be first on this, first on this, and companies can just come in and put these lease applications in, and we're supposed to react to whatever their whims are. When we don't have a plan, we don't have an energy plan, we don't know what, we've got this whole beautiful Gulf of Maine, especially above Casco Bay, and it's not industrialized whatsoever now, pretty much. And we don't even get a chance to decide any of the whys and wherefores or something.
I think I've noticed this. I've been involved in this. It's like the industry's sort of hit. The government's catching up.
Well, the government doesn't like it. I mean, our new governor doesn't want to have anything to do with it. So our former governor put things in the process to start the whole process. Mm-hmm. But then shortly after, he was out of office.
And then started a wind industry business.
Yeah. So, I mean, it set up a process that the current governor doesn't want to deal with, but yet we've already got a...
And it's interesting because some of it seemed like Massachusetts and Rhode Island were way ahead of them.
Well, because it was being pushed by the state.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I think the other thing is just within the siting process that the farther that the discussions around marine spatial planning and these regional planning bodies go, it needs to be clear as to how BOEM is being informed by that work. Because I think fishermen can only pay attention to so much and attend so many meetings. Yeah. And if BOEM's talking about a siting process and they're going to these regional meetings and talking about marine spatial planning, people can't go to every meeting. And there needs to be
it would make sense to have one sort of plan that we want to do in a particular area.
That's a great objective, Susan. Just more.
And it's not that the fishing community is against renewable energy. The acidification meeting next door is that very evident that we're the
first canary in the coal mine.
Yeah, we're the canary in the coal mine. We're the ones who've already seen that maybe this is something happening to codfish, temperature wise. We're the ones who go to these science meetings, realize that at 20 degrees centigrade, lobsters just disappear, at a certain temperature. Or and we're the ones who are going to be whose families are the clamors and the things that are going
to... So I'm just going to say to this point that it seems to me that some different way of getting to the fishermen is important, because the structures that have been in place for all the structures that have been in place for years about fishery management have not included the fishermen until very recently. And so the fishery councils.
New England fishery councils,
they have a few fishermen on them, but mostly it's scientists and management. So there needs to be a better way to get to the fishermen at every site. And that needs to be included. I don't know what the answer to that is, but the current way that it's operating, the fisherman's voice is very minimal.
And they're also, if you go to, let's say, the Fisheries Management Council, there's probably over 7,000 licensed fishermen in Maine, including these inshore scallopers and all those lobstermen up in Cobscott Bay who have nothing to do with the Fisheries Management Council.
That's right.
No contact.
They don't
whatsoever.
Have any contact.
They,
that's
they don't
what I mean.
Regulate their business. All they're pretty much, unless they're into herring or groundfish or to some a little bit of backdoor into lobster, but not directly.
Does the state manage those fisheries?
Because the state and the Atlantic States Fisheries Management Council is to another whole council does that, and the state. Which is a problem in the whole regional planning body, because they throw in one member of the believe in a fisheries management council, but it doesn't really help anybody in Midcoast Maine.
Well, I'm not sure we can solve that problem.
No, I'm not sure. I'm not sure you can solve the problem, but I'm sure that you can think about what other ways you use to get fishermen into talking to you instead of using the standard. The list you gave me, because that one doesn't reach fishermen.
Well, it's for a different reason.
I'll tell you, this is a good information. And we've developed, I've noticed a lot of the comments from meetings. I've got a whole list of things that are going to be supplied to BOEM outside of the goal of these meetings.
Yeah.
It's interesting. And that's kind of that kind of thing.
It is. That's been brought up at the meetings. Absolutely. Go to the, where they get the blood checks.
Brian's boss is here. I mean, see, when you get more and more of the BOEM people actually attending these kind of meetings, they get a little more information in what's going on in the process.
Absolutely.
Read the report later.
You've got to admit, consultants. Okay.
You've got to realize the frustration is that this is going to happen. It's from what I can see, it's not successful. It's not successful in bringing fishermen here, and it wasn't successful in doing that. We're running out of time. We're not successful in covering the material that we need to cover because we didn't allow enough time to do it. And all that, and the meeting's going to get checked off as being done. You guys are going to go home, and I'll still be here to make a living for the next 25 years or whatever out on the water to deal with whatever's left of whatever's gone on here. And this, so that's the frustration.
Yeah.
The meeting's done. It's checked off. It's BOEM's done their thing. They're going to pass the thing. And that's it.
Well, let's make the most of it today, then.
All right. Well, let's do it.
The other thing, too, that on the siting process that I would suggest, I think would help the process, and we've certainly learned this, is the more details on the project in terms of, and this is where Maine's a little different than the rest of the East Coast, is with floating technology. But, I saw there's a couple examples of foundations, but there's no floating ones here. And even in floating, there's a huge difference between a catenary anchor system and a tension lake platform system, and where the cable's going and through what bentham habitat. All that stuff is going to give the fishermen, you can't, it's hard to react to something when it's just a lease block. It's when you have the details of what it actually is going to be, that's what you can actually start to make some informed decisions on what impacts are.
Right. And the problem with that, I understand. I totally agree with you. And that's the process that BOEM is at now, where they're trying to get to. At the one level, they're going to have to require all these things, because you're going to need to know those before you design a specific project. Even though some of these guys are already doing it, that doesn't mean their design aren't going to change once BOEM says you're going to have to do all these different management practices. And like you said, a lot of the industry, they're rolling, man. I mean, sometimes they come to us as consultants and they're halfway through the project and they go, well, what do we need to do from an environmental perspective? And you're like, well, you need to go back about a year and a half and look at how you designed this thing and placed it and all that stuff.
I just think, I think part of it's different here, both in the process but also in the technology. And so I think the more that these materials can reflect what we do know of those technologies, and it's not far enough along to know the real details, but I think it's off-putting to people who are new to this process and show up and say, all this stuff doesn't relate to the situation we're going to be. So I think...
Well, it could in the future.
No, I mean, our state has prioritized floating wind, so they're not going to entertain proposals.
Excuse me for just a minute.
At least to them.
That's what I mean.
They never
Not only so we can move to a fuller conversation discussion, but also because the session next door.
Because that means a demonstration project.
It is. I mean, there's several of us that you may need to see.
So we may be joined by some more folks.
But
so we want to just take a brief break, wrap up these discussions,
and it has
take
a lot of good
break. We'll incorporate
it's understanding what there's still a lot of
discussion. So why don't we take a 10-minute break?
Yeah. Can I add just one piece of feedback on the EMF question?
So
I think what I've heard specifically to this is what are the effects, but also what are so many of the environmental impacts when we scale up the projects? How does that change? So in Maine, these islands I've been talking about are all cabled. Most of them are cabled, you know, 12 miles out from an island to the mainland. So, and this is some of the most productive fishing grounds, you know, in the region. And so right out the islands that you can see outside of this building are cabled, and there's just no lobster going. So to say that this is going to totally turn off and scare all the lobsters, we know from that one cable, it's not true. I think it might provide a great way to study some of this stuff because it's already there and people are fishing near it. But the question that people are concerned about is what happens when you have much bigger cables and many more of them. So a lot of this is the question of cumulative scale.
Okay.
So if that can be addressed, I think that would be good.
I mean, I'm actually curious, just going way back to what you were talking about earlier, did you folks have an outreach plan? Because you were talking about fishermen that are here in the area, but then the problem was people that are, you know, far away that are coming in to fish. And
yeah,
how did you interact with
them? It was just on the ground, boots in the street.
Going and talking to people.
We have an office in Eastport.
Okay.
So we have folks in Eastport, and I was just talking to one of them yesterday, and the folks on the street know everything that is going on, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
And our approach as a developer is to make the company very transparent. You know, we're not looking to hide anything. We're trying to be very open with the community.
Mm-hmm.
We've got very, very positive feedback taking that route.
It's a huge part of our success.
It's so much easier to be local.
That's absolutely right.
Yeah.
We've got five people in our office in Eastport.
Yeah.
Our headquarters in Eastport.
I think what that raises is the difference between you're doing that as a developer, and that's what's making it work. It's not because a federal agency is telling you to do it.
We're way in front of this process.
Yeah.
A lot of different processes.
Well,
so everything we do is...
A lot of these guys down south are doing similar. But here's what I'm seeing. They're all doing sort of, but there's not really a game plan.
Sure. Yeah.
So that's kind of, I think, what Bowen's goal is to...
Yeah.
He's not going to tell you how to do it. He's going to say... They're going to say, these are kind of the parameters you want to work through this process.
And even for us, we have an office in Anchorage, too. We have several sites in the Cook Inlet. And that state is completely different from the state of Maine.
Yeah.
And even Perth is different. The folks that are out working on it, so it's... And NOAA is the same. So it's...
We know.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to say, you've really gone through the ringer probably.
It's the nature of Maine, too. I mean, if they'd come, instead of being Statoil, there was a company that came into Booth Bay and said, you know, they were, had a lot of people who were living there and said, well, we want to try to build this thing. They'd have people going, now, yeah, we'll help you build it, you know, instead of going through all this rigmarole of being combative about it, then being lined up to give them a hand on it or something.
For me, it'd be really those reports from Norway and...
The ones you mentioned?
Yeah.
Okay.
Do they compare, previous amount of fishing rate?
Like baseline information? That's a good question.
They do. I've read through every single one of those and talked with some of the authors of them. There are a number of baseline studies. They were smart enough to say, hey, before we go building here, let's take a sample.
Okay.
Generally, the results have been small increases in aggregation. There have been a couple studies on whether or not it's an enhancement of population. So you have two options. You could either have something that attracts fish from other areas, which isn't really a net benefit. It makes them easier to catch if you're there. Or it actually enhances fish populations without drawing down any other areas. So that question is still trying to be answered, but
that's been there for 20 years.
Yeah, exactly. And this is hopefully something that will help answer it. And we're working on trying to use shipwrecks and other hard surfaces along the East Coast as kind of indicators of what will actually happen with biomass and commercially exploitable fish populations. So they have done baseline studies. There have been some interesting papers that are, not anecdotal, but you know, just in the small area they have to work in, showing aggregations. Cod especially, which is really interesting. There's one paper that shows that cod tend to like aggregating around these structures.
Wow.
Which would be, you know, an interesting wrinkle. It could be very beneficial if there's an aggregation of cod, easier to catch at lower cost. There are some parts of this that could end up being a net positive for the fishing community. There are a number of studies that look before, after. It's called a Backe study, before, after, control.
There's the question of, like, the population that we have now of fish, and then, like, the population we had 10 years ago and the population we had 20 years ago, and I don't know how you can deal with, you know, any kind of a, you know, I don't know how you can do it, but it seems to me that, you know, we want the fish to come back, and we don't know how to make that happen particularly, but it seems to me that sighting would have something to do with that historical basis as well as what occurs now.
That's true. Yeah, I mean, we look a ways back to understand where fishing effort has been. Brian showed some of the maps. I think that Angler's Atlas is from the 1970s.
Yeah.
The VTR data behind you is the last 10 years. And also you have to keep in mind that the ocean is changing. That's what Nextdoor is all about. So
the ocean's changing. Fishing's changing.
Fishing's changing.
Drastically in the last 10
years. It's easy to focus it on, like, we're here to wind energy. Think of all the other facets of the ocean that you have to consider when you look at a management. Like, I was with NOAA and did fishery management. Like, you know, I mean, you know, this is just one facet of multiple things going on within that impact a fishery that you have to consider. And so, you know, when you're building these things, it sounds real easy to do a cumulative analysis. Well, it's not as easy as you think. You don't know, some guy 10 years from now is going to come up with some other idea to go out there. And, you know what I mean? Who knows?
Yeah. In that vein of, I hate to keep pounding on the thing of planning, but they've just had a proposal for a down east closed fishing area to bring back cod in the down east area, which is just what presented in. But something like that, if you had proper planning and were interested in bringing fish back and establishing energy area or something, and were worried about all these problems of joining the two, it certainly could be planned as a combined area where you'd have wind energy plus a closed area for
and all these things can be
but not if you're going to rush into it and have to.
So there's the issue of the holistic point of view, which is not natural to the bureaucracies that we live in. But it, you know, the fishery management has gone one species at a time, and we know that the ocean is one environment. So, you know, everything. So that's what I would say, that there needs to be some cross industry, cross, you know, everybody. There needs to be a horizontal, holistic planning.
It's being mandated by the National Ocean Policy to go to an ecosystem based management process, and that would be that taking all those things, including human behavior and human economics.
It's being mandated by when?
And this is going to be, in essence, it's going to be a requirement in government to switch to this process.
The NEPA process also requires extensive cumulative impact review. That's kind of why we see every single wind energy area on the entire East Coast on here, even though there aren't specific, it cuts off a couple in North Carolina, even though there are very few specific construction plans out there. In fact, there is no actual submitted construction plan for anything except Cape Wind. So you kind of have this trade-off. If you want to look at the holistic view before anything has happened, that's where we are now. But we don't get the nitty-gritty details that we were just talking about wanting 5 minutes ago.
You
can't get everything 1,000-meter view and at the same time specific, you know, exactly what will the bases look like at the same time, unfortunately. So we kind of were...
She would like that layered with what are the codfish spawning ground for
Or
what are the bird migration patterns for?
That's exactly for what the layer of, Brian
what
mentioned
are
it briefly.
Right
the
whale migrating thing. Right.
The MMC, the Marine something cadaster map. Sorry, I forget what the I'm bad with acronyms.
Yeah.
and I have a copy of it, and it's something that goes up on the BOEM website. It's collected from hundreds of sources, and it's something like 700 GIS shapefiles. Anything from shipwrecks to existing pipelines to historic cod fishing grounds that someone at like Rutgers has developed, like going out and speaking with fishermen, old timers, new guys, where are you fishing? And these layers, just you put them on top and on top and on top, and you start to really see a picture of what's out there. So that exists, and we are using that. I have a GIS person right now in my office going through each one of those, cataloging it, and telling and writing up what it tells us about who uses the ocean there to conclude.
Already, but.
Okay.
I think so. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, we do. Thank you.
Glad to hear it.
Now, how we use that is is the question, and that segues nicely into briefly why I'm here.